Well, thank you all for coming. I'm delighted that you are all here. And today we're just going to explore like a whole bunch of different things. And one of the things I like about this environment is they'll actually let me talk about just about anything I want to talk about, right? In a secular audience, people, if I wanted to talk about everything I wanted to talk about there, I would sort of almost have to get permission, or so it seems. But just going to talk freely about a lot of stuff. Welcome. How many of you have never been here before? Okay, so welcome. Glad you're here. I'm going to talk for, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half or something. We're going to do some Q&A, maybe some hot seats like, live problem solving. And then I also, I've got some ministry ideas about what to do at the end, and we'll kind of see how that comes together, but I think it's looking good. So, in 1999, I was working at a job, there's this thing, I call it the compression zone. And the compression zone is when you're 30 years old and, you've got three kids, or at least two, and, you drive like a 1984 Toyota Corolla. And it's very rusty, and you bought it for $1,200, which was a really good deal, and it works surprisingly well. Doesn't have an air conditioner, but who's asking? Burns a little oil, and like you rush out of the morning and try not to get yogurt on your shirt, and you get to work by 7:15, and then you work all day, intimacy is two kids and two adults in the same bed. That's what intimacy is. There's never enough money, and like the boss is always pounding you, especially at the end of the month to get the sales quota, and you don't feel respected and you don't feel appreciated, and the stress just pulls you from like every direction. So that's like where we were. But I was starting, like in fits and starts, my career was starting to kind of come to, starting to happen. And as a result of that, this guy wanted to hire me to do some consulting work, and he was going to pay me $3,000 to do it. And so because of that, we decided that we could go on a trip to Brazil to see my brother-in-law, who was going to move back home. He had lived there for 10 years, and he had run this Christian publishing house, and he was in charge of a street kid ministry, and we booked the plane tickets, and then the consulting deal fell through, and so it's just more debt. But we went anyway. We had no business going on this trip, but we just did it because, well, you know how it is. But that was my first trip to what I call the jagged edge. We went to Sao Paulo, Brazil. Okay? And Sao Paulo, Brazil, imagine a metro area about a third the size of Chicagoland with twice as many people. Okay? Like dingy gray skyscrapers as far as the eye can see. And the hills, like around the edges of Sao Paulo are just filled with these things called favelas, slums, right? And in fact, this guy named Paulo took us on a one-day tour of the favelas. He's like, come with me. And we get in his car and he takes us and we like go to the slums. And, we're walking these little alleys. So, picture these these either, you know, tin shacks or concrete hovels with extension cords, extension cords, extension cords, extension cords going like everywhere, wherever they get the electricity and however that works, right? You know, I'm sure there's a whole weird little economy just about extension cords. Somebody could get their master's degree probably studying how it works. And it was like a totally eye-opening experience. Okay? It's like, wow. I came home from that trip and I'm like, we got no pollution. We got no poverty. The Inglewood neighborhood in Chicago is really safe. Okay? Seriously. Like, I'm not joking. The safest neighborhood in Sao Paulo is more dangerous than the most dangerous neighborhood in Brazil. Okay? And if my brother-in-law lived in this... the first word that comes to mind is compound. They live in this house, and it's this gated community, and in the middle of it, there's this little guard shack, and every night a security guard comes and works there, and he blows a whistle every 15 minutes, and that's how everybody knows he's alive. And this is normal, okay? This is normal. This is not like some weird thing. Like, any, like, middle-class neighborhood, you know, is like this. And, like, all the houses, the way the house is and everything, every house is like a fortress because, you know, there's just so much crime. And so I just got this completely different view of my life. And, in fact, I remember for probably 2 or 3 weeks, I could feel my brain just processing everything that I just experienced because it completely tilted my perspective of everything, right? It's like Bill Clinton is an honest politician, you know? I mean, this was, you know, this whole new perspective. And Laura and I actually decided, if we ever get out of this, you know, like financial rut that we're in, we're going to make going to places like this a regular occurrence, right? Like, life on planet Earth is not all caramel lattes and frequent flyer bonus points, right? It made me feel very grounded, right? And so, a few years went by, and things dramatically improved. They didn't improve to where I was, like, rich, but they improved to where, like, the financial pressure is off. I have some choices. I can go on trips. You know, like I'll never forget the first Christmas that we actually had some money. Like, instead of, well, you know, we really can't afford any of this, but I guess we're going to spend $200 anyway. It, like, wasn't like that anymore. It's like, oh, well, you know, I can kind of get Laura what she wants, and she can get me what I want. And like, that was pretty cool. Well, not too long after that, I go to Africa. And to make a long story short, I went to see this guy who ran a foster care program for AIDS orphans. So I was making good on my, like, okay, you know, I'm going to go to the jagged edge and I'm going to do this and, like, get my reality check every once in a while. And so I spent a day, and George takes me around, and I'm meeting all these kids, and the thing they all have in common is they've all lost both parents to AIDS. Okay, now I don't know what the numbers are now, but I know the numbers then were, every day, 6,000 people died of AIDS in Africa. Everybody you meet, everybody you see walking down the street has lost at least one extended family member to AIDS. Okay? So after a day and a half of this, like, I'm, you know, it's pretty depressing. And I had this, like, nagging thought in the back of my head, which was, okay, you know, it's nice to do charity and it's nice to, but like, how about helping these people like permanently get out of their state that they're in instead of just like putting a band-aid on? Okay, so I could sponsor a kid at $30 a month and I could put a band-aid on this deal and that's good, but like, can you solve this? Like, for good. And I go, hey, George, you ever heard of microloans? And he goes, oh, yeah, we do those too. You want to meet some of those people? Yeah, that would be refreshing. So he's like, so all of a sudden we are just like on this whole different thing. And he shows me this woman who has a vegetable stand. And, you know, it was a cardboard thing nailed together with vegetables on top. And she started it with $50, but it was enough of a business to feed her family. Okay, so she's out of the rut, right? She's out of deep poverty. Then we go to this other village, and there's this guy, and his name is Paul, and he's a crippled cobbler. Now that's, you know, nice little irony for you. He's sitting there against the wall, and his crutches are leaning against the wall, and he's fixing shoes, and there's a line of people in the place, and I'm talking to him through the translator. And, you know, and he's talking back to me, and I noticed something. And what I noticed was, everywhere that I went in Africa, everybody was very nice, and they were very hospitable and welcoming and everything, but they all had this, like, worn down by sandpaper look in their eyes. It was just this kind of glassy, you know, another day in the grind kind of look. And he did not have that look in his eye. The look in his eye was, I'm here, and you're here, and we're here, and there's a line of people, you know, coming in the door. And my kids have uniforms for school, and they got their books, and they're getting their education, and I'm feeding my family, and I'm a pillar in the community, and this is good. And I have this flashback. And the flashback, like, rewind, I don't know, probably 10 years. And I'm like, I'm in some coliseum, and I'm standing at an Amway convention, and we're gonna get rich, and, you know, and go diamond, and all this stuff. And squirting the sweet shot in the air. And it's funny how many people laugh at this, like, with that, yeah, I did that too, kind of expression, right? Everybody's like, almost everybody's done, especially in an entrepreneur meeting, like, almost everybody's done some version of that, right? You know? And so the gut reaction to that is, oh, that was ridiculous. But then, like, the flashback about was, hey, wait a minute. It wasn't really about Cadillacs and diamond rings and fur coats. It certainly wasn't for me, okay? I don't know about anybody else, but it was about being self-sustaining. It was about waking up every morning and doing what you believe to be important, not what somebody else believes to be important. And it's about having some control of your financial destiny. And I'm standing there in this store, if you could call it that, you know, in a cobbler shop in Kenya, and I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Maybe that wasn't so ridiculous after all. You know? Maybe it's true if you can jump up and down and get excited about the Chicago Bulls scoring a 2 points. Maybe you could jump up and down and get excited about somebody having a successful business. And, you know what? Sponsoring kids for 30 bucks a month is good, and starting schools is good, and planting churches is good, and missionaries is good, and aid is good, and, you know, and medical clinics are good. But if there's not a cobbler in a cobbler's shop making a profit, none of that gets paid for, ever. Like, none of it. Like, I remember, somebody, one of my friends telling me, he was talking to somebody, and it's like, so what do you want to do when you go to college? Oh, I want to work for a big multinational like UNICEF. It's like, hey, wait a minute. They take money from other people and give it away. Like, they're not fundamentally solving the problem. Entrepreneurs fundamentally solve the problem. Okay? If you don't have an entrepreneur, you ain't got nothing. Okay? And ever since then, like, the switch flipped in my mind. Perry. Okay, especially since you train entrepreneurs, guess what? What you do is really important. But I was talking to Alex, this guy right here, before this started, and he was talking about how he always, it sounded really familiar because it was like, maybe I should do some kind of Christian ministry. Maybe I should commit myself to some really good cause. But I always just, my heart always seems to get pulled into business. And, and if it's like, I don't know. Maybe business isn't so bad. Maybe business is a place where you can have a ministry. And I'm like, absolutely it is. More than you know. And that's what we're going to talk about today. There is no conflict. And in fact, as we go on along here, I think you're going to see that it is every bit as important, every bit as valuable of a calling and a spiritual giftedness as anything, anything that goes on under a pope or a bishop or a church or anything like that. So I want to talk to you. I'm in the book of Daniel, chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put the treasure in the house of his God. Then it goes on, and he wants to recruit some of the Jewish young men, and you end up with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they give them Babylonian names, and they are now in service of the king. Let's put this in a little bit of context. I think when you just sort of casually read the Daniel Sunday school stories, you sort of picture Daniel as sort of this Justin Bieber kind of guy, and he's really cool. And he somehow seems to have this magic sprinkling dust on him somehow. And he's really wise. And so they like him. And so like, hey, we're bad. Well, no, that's not really an accurate picture. Okay. If you want the context, really, it's almost like, and the Nazis came into the church and urinated on the grand piano, they completely desecrated everything they consider holy. And these guys, they're like Hasidic Jews. Okay? Like, you have any friends that are Hasidic Jews and they wear the black coats and the yarmulkes and the little tassels and everything, and they are really serious about the Sabbath, and they eat kosher, and they can't even live in Indianapolis because there is no kosher in Indianapolis. So you have to live in Chicago or you have to live in New York. You can't just live in Oak Park because you have to live in Rogers Park because that's where all the kosher bakeries are. I mean, this is these guys, okay? And they are thrust into this completely hostile environment that makes their skin crawl. Okay? So that's the context, right? But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. See? Hasidic Jew, you know, kind of thing, right? And he asked the chief official permission not to defile himself this way. Now God caused the official to show favor. That's a word we like here at GCC. Favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid my lord the king, blah, blah, blah. He would have my head if we do this. And Daniel's like, well, you know, let's try this out for 10 days. And it turns out, you know, he sticks to his vows and he sticks to his convictions. And it says, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand the visions and dreams of all kinds. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned him, he found them 10 times better. Amen. 10 times better than all of the magicians, enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, if you watch any movie, you read any novel, there is a structure that the thing pretty much always follows, and here's what it is. It starts out either with paradise or some faint memory of paradise. Okay? So, we watch Lord of the Rings, and it's the very first one, and the hobbits are all, right? And everything's great, right? And Bilbo Baggins has his nice little house and everything, right? Okay, but then for some reason, Bilbo decides he needs to disappear. Sauron can see you, don't you know this? Okay, and there is a disaster. All right? Okay, and then a hero who is almost always an orphan. I mean, you think about every Disney movie you can think of. Cinderella, The Lion King, Bambi, Star Wars. Luke, I am your father. Right? Just about. In fact, the other day I went to see Pompeii. Right? So Pompeii, a new movie just came out. I knew nothing about it. Except that it has something to do with that volcano. Right? That's all I know. I'm like, well, I wonder who the orphan's going to be in Pompeii. So I get there, and the movie starts, and the Romans are burning a village, and they kill both of his parents, and off he goes. Like, yep, I knew it. Okay. So the orphan gets a summons. Hey, we got a job for you. Hey, Luke Skywalker. You want to fight the dark side? Join the resistance? Hey, Neo! Right? Okay. Then there's a battle. Sometimes it goes on for like three sequels, but there's battle and battle and battle and battle and battle, right? Okay. Then, loss. Deep, grievous loss. Right? Okay. Then, when all hope is almost lost,
there is redemption. And usually it involves some kind of transcendent element. Right? Luke, listen to the force. Press the button when the force tells you to. And he goes right over that, you know, long channel in the Death Star, and he pushes the button, you know, and then the long silence while you wait and wait and wait. Right? The force came through, right? Redemption. Right? Then you win the kingdom. And then you get the girl. Notice you don't get the girl living in your mom's basement. And she gets a job so she can support your drumming career. Or guitar. Or keyboards. Or lead singer. Or pretend I'm Justin Bieber. Okay? Like, you don't get the girl here before you decide to have a battle. You get the girl here after you won the battle. All the stories are like this. Ever noticed?
Yes.
Now, from now on, you can't go to a Disney movie and not notice the orphan.
Right.
They're playing me. They are playing me. They are manipulating my emotions. Yes, they are. And when you're a marketer, you learn that everybody's going to get their emotions manipulated. It's just whether they get manipulated by good people or bad people. Hello? Okay, so you know, like, when David kills Bathsheba's husband and he sleeps with Bathsheba, and Nathan shows up and he tells him a story about a family with a little lamb, and the guy kills the lamb for dinner for his guest, even though he's got 100, and David is outraged. Oh, Nathan, that manipulator. Yes, he did. He manipulated David into seeing his guilt. Okay? Like, don't be sheepish about manipulating people. If you're sheepish about being manipulated, being manipulative, it's because you're being manipulated already and you don't want to admit it. So admit it and, like, get wise to it. All right. So, Joseph. I'm going to point out something I think is pretty interesting. Genesis 39. So Joseph has his dream, and then his brothers don't like him, and he gets sold into slavery. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites. Now understand, Ishmaelites. Okay, Arabs. People Jews don't like. Okay, like, right? Like, that sandpaper thing is going on with him too, right? Who had taken him there. In verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. And he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and entrusted to his care everything he owned. Okay, and then Potiphar's wife wants to seduce him, and then she tries, and then hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and so now she blames Joseph, right? Okay, and then Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him.
showed him favor and kindness, and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. There's that favor word again. Now, there you go, right? Isn't this like all over again? Everything was great. I got my coat of many colors, and then there's a disaster, right? You know, then there's a battle, and there's a loss. And he sits there in prison for a long time, and then a redemption comes, and then he wins the kingdom, and he gets the girl. Yeah, and he, yeah, it's Pharaoh's daughter. Okay? Now, back to Daniel. So, Daniel chapter 2. Read you just a little bit of that. Nobody can interpret the king's dream. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Took a little courage. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so he and his friends might not be executed during the rest of the wise, with the rest of the wise men in Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then he goes on and he interprets a dream. Well, so then in the next chapter, nobody likes Daniel, so he gets thrown in the lion's den. But the king likes him and God saves him. And then you go through the whole Daniel's career. Actually, I think I'll read you a little bit more of this. I'll just summarize that when the handwriting is on the wall, and the king is so terrified that he can't stand up, the queen says, "Hey, there's a guy, get him in here." It's like, "Oh, well, tell us what this means, we'll give you everything you want." It's like, "I don't need any of that stuff, but here's what the wall means." Like, and recess is over. Right? Now, there is a version, there's a strand of Christianity that people call the health and wealth gospel. And that actually means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. The extreme version of it is, Jesus died so you could drive a BMW. Okay? Well, you know, the Bible is a success book from the beginning to the end. It is a success manual. I am totally okay with the health and wealth gospel as long as we remember that this is how it goes. Some people think you start from here and you go to here, and like, that's it. Not how my book reads. Okay? You ever stop and think about John the Baptist? I mean, John had Elijah's anointing. Elijah! He is practically almost Elijah reincarnated. I mean, that's a real head twister if you sit there and read it. Are you Elijah? Are you Elijah? Like, I don't even know like how they knew this, but their spirits must have been telling them that. And now John's in prison, and would you just like ask Jesus, "Are you the one that we thought you were?" Okay, yeah, now we chuckle at that. I mean, listen, John the Baptist had a long day, dark night of the soul.
He did. And when John got beheaded, Jesus himself had to grieve. So, I am totally okay with a health and wealth gospel as long as you understand that Daniel's the template. Was Daniel healthy? Yes, he was healthier than everybody. Was he wealthy? Yeah, they wanted to give him more stuff than he ever even possibly needed. Was he influential? Yes. Was there a lion's den? Yes. Was there the sandpaper of living in Babylon with these uncircumcised Philistines? No, not Philistines, Babylonians, whatever. Right? Did he get to worship the way he wanted? Did he long for Jerusalem? You know, I wish I had time to tell you more of the story, possibly later, but Jerusalem is a thin place. Jerusalem is a place where the space between heaven and earth is thinner than it is everywhere else. And if you go down the rabbit trail, you'll find there are thin places in the world. And if you've ever experienced one, like on a deep level, it feels like home in a way that nothing else ever does. If you have good friends who are Jewish people and they are Zionists, and they like been to Jerusalem several times, maybe they lived in Israel for 6 months or something like that, they have relatives there, they miss home. They might live in Brooklyn, but Brooklyn is not home. Jerusalem is home. Daniel missed home. Prospering in Babylon. That's what it's about. So, one of the things you need to understand is that no matter how prosperous you become, something will always not be right. Now, I think entrepreneurs, if you have the entrepreneur calling, and if it's in your blood, you have an awareness of money, you have an awareness of authority, you have an awareness of freedom, you have an awareness of your own personal choices. And you have a desire to be able to express your ways, yourself, in ways that other people don't seem to have. Okay, so if you did your time in Amway or Nu Skin or something like that for a while, you know that 90% of the people in the world, if you say, you could own your own business, they'll look at you like you're from Mars. Like, why would I want to do that? You know? You know, I'm a poodle and I live in this apartment and the people bring me this, you know, the food bowl twice a day and they bring me the water bowl and I get to, you know, sleep on the couch and I get to watch TV with the kids and I get to sleep with a 7-year-old at night and like it's really great. So why would I want to be a Wolverine and like have to go kill, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner and freeze to death in the cold? And because you could be free. You could be wild and free. And the poodle's like, why would I want to do that? I can watch that from the patio window. And the grass is mowed. Why would I want to live in the forest? Okay, but if you're an entrepreneur, you like want to live in the forest. And you're like, I'm going crazy with this food bowl and the linoleum floor and the carpet. It's driving me crazy. And these stupid TV shows. I can't stand these stupid TV shows. How can anybody stand to live this existence? They are sleeping, walking through life. They are following people who are following people who are lost down the expressway, just following the taillights with hot, sludgy coffee between their legs, sloshing around. And then they sue somebody when they get burned, like, this is nutso. Okay, so back to what I was... Sorry, that was kind of fun, actually.
So, like, you have this awareness in, like, I have to get out of this squirrel cage. I will scream if I, you know, like, if I'm 56 years old and I am still working at that big dumb company because of health insurance, I think I will drive my car into a wall. So, like, I was really feeling this burn, like, all through my 20s. Okay? Like, about two-thirds of the way through college, I figured out that everybody's going to get out of here and they're going to go get a job and then they're just going to, like, exist. Right. And I remember one day sitting in class and, you know, the teacher's talking, whatever, and there's this guy, like, one row over and one desk ahead of me, and he's got a piece of paper and he's writing the number $32,000. Obviously, that was his job offer. And he's looking at that number, and I know what he's thinking. He's thinking, what a bloody fortune. Grad school pays $8,000 a year, and that job pays $32,000. I'm going to be rich. Well, then you, like, get the job, and you move into the apartment, and you find you're really not rich at all. And you're going to budget, and you can go to Giordano's once a month, and you can rent a movie once a week, and then you're out of money. And then you get your student loans, right? Well, so I escaped. I escaped. About, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, I got out. And I realized something. And I realized it the first time I went to Africa. Guess what, Perry? Just because you got what you wanted doesn't mean everybody else has what they want. The world is still broken. And actually, it created this awareness because, it's hard to put into words, but it's like, well, I think I must have had some idea that if I escaped from the poodle world and got myself into the Wolverine world, that, like, I was just going to be okay with everything. But I couldn't be okay with everything because I'm still living in Babylon and there's still hungry kids and there's still all these problems in the world and, you know, and there's still all the stuff that goes on in the newspaper every day, you know, and I can't just shift into neutral. Not like I really would ever even get away with it if I did, but even if I thought, you know, even if you think that you're just going to, like, get to some point where you just shoot yourself up with some Novocaine and, you know, live in an attic somewhere with lots of nice things, like, no, that's not going to solve your problems. You know, and I remember this conversation with this lady when I was 17, actually I was 16. I'll never forget this. She goes, she's my friend's mom. And her husband was this really successful businessman. And she goes, and we're driving. She's one of these just, like, totally straight, tell it like it is, unvarnished kind of people, right? And she goes, so, Barry, you know what a midlife crisis is? And I go, yeah, it's when you're making $30,000 a year and you realize that it's never going to be better than that. And you have this, like, big emotional upheaval. And she goes, oh, well, if you're making $30,000 a year, you should have a big emotional upheaval. I'm like, well, sorry, Dad, you know. And she goes, ah, yeah, but well, all right. So that's like a middle class midlife crisis. You know what a rich man's midlife crisis is? And I go, no, what's that? She goes, well, it's when, like everybody everywhere worships you and thinks you're great, and then you go home and they don't worship you, and you go, well, I'm tired of this, and then you go get a mistress, and then you. And then you start all over again, and then 15 years later, you have the same problems you had when you were 40. I'm like, okay, that's a useful piece of information. I'll try to, you know, try to be mindful of that. And so anyway, you know, I've got a client who years ago he was scraping by. bologna sandwiches, ramen soup, overdraft notices, you know, the whole nine yards. And now, like, he's doing really well. He's making lots of money. He works only a few hours a day. He can go spend 6 weeks in Italy and, like, do all this kind of stuff. And he's actually kind of miserable. And it's not any fault of his success that he's miserable. But I think there's two things that are making him miserable. Number one, he, like pretty much all of us, has things that he needs to sort out in his heart. And he needs to figure out what his purpose really is. Because, you know, when your own gratification is like the be-all, end-all, you know, every dictatorship in the world, that's basically what it turned into. And it's they all end the same way. And so, you know, all right, so you're in Babylon. Guess what? It's never going to quite feel like home. So don't let yourself believe that it is, since it's not. Okay? And your job is to reform Babylon. Now, I think the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament is, in the Old Testament, there's one Daniel, and in the New Testament, there's a million. Everybody can be, in their own unique way, a Daniel. And that's what you're here to do. Notice how it says, and God was with Joseph. And God was with Joseph. And God was with Daniel. And God was with Daniel. I want you to notice something about when it says that. You know, Bill Johnson's got this series called, it's like whatever the latest thing is, Hosting the Presence. And he goes, have you ever noticed that every time in the Bible God says, fear not, for I am with you? It's because, like, the eye of Sauron is, you know, like, right on him right then. It's like, do not be afraid, do not be afraid, do not be afraid. And who did he say that to? Joshua. And what's he doing? Oh, pretty much taking over Palestine. Right? It's a huge job. Like, nobody even believes it's possible. Okay? So here's the thing. You know, you can live a life that's like, this is your Friday TV show, this is your Friday movie night, you know. You can live that life, or you can live this one, but you can't live both. Okay? And by the way, screenwriters, people that make movies, they have a name for this. There's a name for this. It's called Hero's Journey. What, you want me to carry the ring to Mordor? Whatever for? Because it's partly because you're special and mostly because nobody else wants to do it. I mean, that's the truth. Okay? Daniel, my, like, gestalt impression of Daniel is he is an eminently practical mystic. He holds the numinous in the divine and the spiritual in one hand, and he holds the practical needs of Babylon and the king and whatever he's needed for in the other. And look at how God uses him. I mean, to the point of prophesying the rise and fall of the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire, and he all names them, and it's all accurate before it happened. It's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Foretold Christ. He there's a scene where he prays for an answer, and it takes 21 days to get the answer. And finally, the angel comes to him and he says, I was delayed 21 days by the prince of Persia. Well, this is not a man, you understand. This is hard on spiritual warfare. The hero's journey is not an easy one. The entrepreneur journey is not an easy one. You know, some days the Wolverines look at the poodles through the patio door and like, wow, they don't have to meet payroll. You know? There is a talk that you can go find. You can find an audio of it. You can find a transcript. It's by Arthur C. Brooks. And he's an economist, and he did this very careful study of thousands of families, and well, let me tell you a little story that'll kind of give some context to this. I had a friend come up to me not too long ago, and she goes, so you know how like at church they say you can't outgive God and stuff like that? Like, yeah, you know, and you kind of get the pitch about, you know, you should give more and you should be more generous so God can bless you. And, you know, and they read the verses, you know, like, you know, if you will, you know, bring the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will be not enough room to receive it. And she's going, you know, just hasn't quite been happening so far. And I said, and I remembered when we were talking, I remembered hearing this Arthur Brooks thing, and I went back and I looked it up. And they carefully studied all these families, and they studied the cause and the effect, and it was very detailed. And what they found out was, for every $100 that people gave out of generosity, they later received $375. And he's like, and we ran the numbers again, and we ran them again, and it was like, I couldn't believe this, because the cause and effect seemed backwards, but in fact, statistically, for every dollar they gave, four came back. Now here's what I told my friend. I said, okay, that is, you should think of it like, you know, all the promises, like, okay, so let me give you an idea what I'm talking about. Blessed is a man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, or sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and his law does he meditate day and night, and he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bringeth forth its shoot in season. His leaf will not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will bring it to pass. Right? I have been young, and now I am old. Yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, or his seed begging bread. He is ever merciful and lendeth, and the seed is blessed. The righteous shall flourish like a palm tree. He will grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Therefore take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? For all these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you have need of these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and these things will be added to you. Honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase, so that shall thy barns be filled with plenty and presses burst out with new wine. My God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches by the anointing of Christ Jesus. If you extend your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then your light shall dawn in the darkness. Your darkness will be as noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought, and strengthen your bones. You shall be like a watered garden and like a spring of water. Those waters do not fail. Right? Promises of God. Well, here's what I told her. I said, these are not one-to-one cause-effect certainties. If you want an analysis, they are statistical probabilities. They put you on a different end of the bell curve, but that doesn't mean that it's like 100% all the time. Now, Laura and I, when our business started to get healthy and good, we started having this disagreement about how much to give. And she wanted to give according to a formula that made no sense to me, like logically. It didn't make sense to anybody else either, by the way, so just in case you're wondering if I'm sane. But one of my mentors, who is not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever, made this interesting comment. He said, he goes, you give and receive out of the same orifice. he said, it's the darndest thing, but, and like, no engineer would ever, like, you could never explain this, but, like, the more you give, the more you get. He was talking about that $375 to $100 ratio thing. Okay, he goes, Bill Gates doesn't have a Bill and Melinda Foundation because he's generous. It's because he knows it makes him more money. Because it's some cosmic law of the universe. Like, well, I don't know. I'm actually willing to give Bill Gates more credit than that. But I think it's actually true. I do. And so my mentor convinced me. And so I go back to Laura and I go, okay, we're going to do it your way. Well, isn't it funny? Like a wheelbarrow money started showing up. Okay, now again, I'm not promising you that this is like one-to-one. But here's what I do believe. I believe, by the way, there's an article on my website. It's about entrepreneurs and our greed or something like that. You could search it, you could find it. And there's a study where somebody like got all this IRS data and it showed that entrepreneurs are twice as generous as everybody else. And that low-income entrepreneurs are even more generous than the high-income ones. And my experience is, I mean, I have worked with thousands of people and I've probably seen every kind of entrepreneur you can think of. My experience is that most entrepreneurs are people who they came up with something that is good, that is so good that they want to share it with the world, and frankly, they would give it away for free if they could, except that business doesn't work that way, so they have to make a business out of it, and they have to charge money for it, and they learn to do it. But they serve customers more out of a sense of responsibility and a desire to make the world a better place than they do for the desire to fatten the cash register. And I think, now, that can be taken too far. You can be too generous in business because it's a business, it's not Sunday school, and if you give everything away, you won't have anything, right? But, you know, and I think increasingly in the 21st century, every business has, you know, there's just so much transparency. Every business has to provide more value than what it takes. Like, by definition, that's what a business does. Okay, so, you know, you could always find somebody who wants to sit there and go, oh yeah, you know, those rich guys at Google. Well, you know what? You don't ever have to give Google a dime, and you have access to the biggest computer network in the world and all the world's information, and they answer just about any question you could ever want, and it's free. Like, do you realize what a shift, what a complete shift that is in humanity? In 1346, when could you ever get anything that valuable for free ever from anybody? Right? I mean, we live in an abundant world. Right? They became some, top 10 richest people in the world by giving the world something more valuable than it had ever had before. Right? And wisdom comes from God. Ideas come from God. So, if your conscience, if your heart is saying to be generous, don't let your big thinking brain put on the brake and stop your heart from being generous. I think generosity, it's just a way of being, okay? Let's see. We're making good time. I'm going to tell you an interesting story. You know, where I grew up, I mean, everybody comes from a different place, but where I grew up, the idea of God actually talking to you was like, you know, don't be talking like that. Now, it's kind of funny because nobody ever really analyzed it. You know, it was like, they certainly assumed that if you prayed, that somehow the outworking of your circumstances would, you know, lead you in the right direction, you know, or that, you know, if you had one job offer in Philadelphia and another job offer in Kansas City, that somehow if you prayed that God would show you, except just somehow or another, he was never going to actually tell you. Okay? Well, I'm glad I got rid of that little belief. And in fact, when you ask God a question, probably the best assumption you might make is that the answer is the very first thing that comes into your head. And it doesn't mean you jump up and go do it right now. Many times you shouldn't jump up and go do it right now, but you should at least write it down and not miss it as it goes by. Right? Yeah, I know God can do 3 miles an hour, but he can do light speed too. Right? And, you know, I would say probably one of the most valuable things that I've gotten from being a member of this spiritual community here is cultivating the practice of listening to God and learning how to do it. Some people, it seems to come fairly easy. Some of us, you know, it's like we're in the back of a moving truck and there's 6 tons of furniture between us and the voice of God, and we have to like move it out of the way and then we can hear God. It's like, well, okay, if you got 6 tons of furniture between you and hearing God, then get the moving crew and like let's get the show on the road. Because even if it takes you 6 years to learn how to listen to God, then 6 years from now, you'll be 6 years older whether you learn how to listen to God or not. So you might as well learn how to listen to God. And so it's, so I had this client come to, I do this thing called a 4-man intensive. And this guy came and he mentioned on the first day he made mention of the fact that he was embroiled in a bogus lawsuit. And he told us some of the details, which I won't repeat. But it had been hanging over his head for 2 years. And he goes, I don't want to talk about that. Let's just move on and let's like get something done today. Okay. And he mentioned at dinner, he goes, you know, I didn't think about that lawsuit all afternoon. It's like, that's the first time ever. You know, because he was having such a good time talking to everybody and brainstorming and masterminding. The next morning, I'm sitting there and I got my notebook. And I'm talking to God, and what works for me is ask God a question, and like first thing that comes in, just write it down. So I'm doing this, and I ask God about this guy. And what I felt like I heard God saying was, talk to him about what they do in the financial SOZO sessions. And for those of you who don't know, SOZO is a inner healing prayer ministry where instead of laying on a couch and talking to a therapist about your mother, what you do is the facilitator prompts you to ask God a question. You know, like, okay, God, when was the first time that I felt that hatred or, you know, something like that? And you wait for God to answer. So it's the recipient who's hearing. So the way it's set up, it's very hard for the facilitator to impose their agenda on any of it because all they can do is ask questions which they are not allowed to answer. Right? You know, and I got trained in SOZO, and I remember this one guy going, boy, when I pray, it's usually static, but like in here with all you guys, it's like crystal clear. And he was weirded out. It's like he'd never experienced this before. Yeah, I know the feeling, right? Well, you can cultivate that, right? And you can get to where, well, it's not all static for you either, even when you're by yourself. So anyway, and one of the things that they do in the SOZO sessions is forgive people and bless people. And God said, I want you to bring this up and talk about forgiving and talk about blessing and, you know, and just bring this up before the day starts. So everybody shows up at 9 and we're getting the preliminaries out of the way and it's 9:20 and I start talking. I say, hey, I want to talk about that lawsuit you're in. Okay. And so I talked to him. I said, so here's what I would like to invite you to bless this person who's suing you, even though it makes no sense whatsoever. And it's easy for me to say and hard for you to do, and I totally get that. But I want you to take the posture of blessing her and asking God to put good things in her life, even if she doesn't deserve it. And he goes, he's some flavor of Christian, don't know what. And he's like, okay. And then it was 9:24, okay, so it was a 4-minute conversation. At 9:24, his phone buzzes. He pulls out his phone and he goes, my attorney wants me to call him right away. And I go, it's good news. And his wife goes, it's never good news when that guy calls. I said, it's good news. Take the call. Leaves the room and he comes back and he goes, they want to settle. And they're willing to settle for $10,000 less than I decided 2 weeks ago that I would settle for. And a couple weeks later, done. Now, in GCC lingo, we call that shifting atmospheres. So, when you got up here and you said, Sharon, this is Sharon Lyons, by the way. Sharon said, you know, I don't know, she laid on the floor, did some weird thing, which we do things, weird things around here. This is not the weirdest thing you'll ever see at GCC. And then she says, I want you to open a window and the light is going to shine on the mountain that's in front of you, like whatever, and something's going to shift. Okay, she's doing the same thing. God told her, apparently, go do this weird thing, right? You know? It's like, well, go march around the city 3 times, or go bathe in the Jordan River, or whatever weird thing. Well, like, why would I do that? I don't know. Do not ask me. That's a memo from the head office. I do not run the head office. I am not in charge of the head office. I get memos too. They don't make any sense either. I just do them, okay? Hopefully, at least they do it most of the time. Sort of, kind of. I try. Okay, I'm trying really hard. And, well, that's being a Daniel. Now, another thing I believe that events like that are written in invisible ink. And you will forget them unless you tell the story until somebody can kick you in the middle of the night and wake you from a deep sleep. Tell me a God story. And you're like, oh, there's this client and he was in this lawsuit. And like, you could, like, seriously. Miracles are like this. I've seen, now, if you rewind, you know, probably 10 or 12 years ago, I hadn't seen any miracles, ever. I had only heard about them, read about them in books, and they were only the kooky books, because they weren't in the politically correct books. But I didn't know, like, I don't know, maybe they are making this stuff up. Maybe it is all placebo effect. Maybe these people are all pathological liars. I don't know, I wasn't there. Okay? But after a while, like, I've seen a lot of miracles. I've seen two deaf people not be deaf anymore in one ear. It wasn't both ears deaf, but two times it was one deaf ear opened up, healed. I've seen it. I was sitting right next to the lady when it happened. I interviewed her later. It's on YouTube. Like, but I have to remind myself, because those experiences run on a different set of rails than the normal following the taillights down the expressway, following the hypnotized person to the other hypnotized person who goes to the office where everybody's hypnotized. Yesterday, I went to... Okay, so the TSA, you know, the airport scanning orifice people? There's something where you can get a registration so you can bypass it. And so I applied online and I had this appointment. And it's down at like 76 and State Street. You know, in this like ghetto, and there's this building. So I go to the address and there's nothing about the TSA thing anywhere on the little punch button entry thing on the door. Nothing at all, right? You know? And so I'm standing there and there's another guy and we're both looking at it. We're like, do you see any TSA in here? I don't see any TSA in here. And we're in the ghetto, you know, it's really great. I've got a laptop computer. Oh, I was an idiot for bringing a laptop into the hood, you know? And I'm standing here with this guy, you know. You know. So if y'all think I have a high IQ, no, I'm more like autistic, okay? Some guy comes through the door and we go in and you know, and I walk, okay, so we go in this office and there's this lady who like doesn't even look up at you, and there's all these people sitting in chairs watching a reality TV show where they're arguing about something and everybody's hypnotized. I'm like, these people are seriously sleepwalking, like, you know, like, my name gets called. I go stand in front of the lady. She doesn't even look at me. Finally, after 10 minutes, I go sit back down. And finally, I go, did you call my name for a reason? She goes, oh, yeah, you're going to be up. But, like, that guy's not here, so you're not up right now. You know, like, anyway. I'm just thankful it's not Lithuania, where I'd have to do it 14 times. Right? And it would take 3.5 years. There's another verse. This is not a happy, happy, joy, joy verse, but I think it needs to be said anyway. Hebrews 12:5. And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father?
If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. So, and by the way, the New American Standard translates it, he scourges every son who he receives. It's like, oh, I really don't like that verse. Like, okay, I'm ready for my scourging. Can't wait. Oh, you know, you missed right here. Oh, yeah, yeah, just get that part. Oh, yeah, I haven't been punished in that part for a long time. Oh, that's good. Hey, you know what? I'm cool with the health and wealth gospel as long as they don't chop out that part. Did God prosper Joseph? Thank you. Did God prosper Joseph? Oh my goodness, he did. Major big time. You know, Karl Barth, the Swiss theologian, once said, you want proof of the existence of God? Look at the Jews. 4,000 years. It's the only intact civilization. Okay? Babylonians are gone. The Greeks are gone. Persians are gone. Hittites are gone. Amorites are gone. Go down a big long list. They're all gone. Jews. Still standing. Same holidays, same diet, same language, same religion. There are about 12 to 15 million Jewish people in the whole world. But 10 to 20% of every intellectual profession is Jewish. Walk into a university library and go find, you know, all the journals that you can't even understand because they're written in, you know, advanced legalese, advanced sociologyese, advanced economicsese, advanced physics, advanced mathematics. 20% of the names in those journals are Jewish. ...112 Jewish Nobel Prize winners, one Chinese. So, 112 out of 12 million versus one out of a billion. Are the Jewish people blessed? Yes. Are they on a different bell curve than everybody else?
Yes.
Okay. Second oldest intact civilization. The church. Original mothership, Catholic Church, goes back to Ignatius and Polycarp. And I'm not really making a statement about the Catholic Church one way or the other, but it is the mothership. And you can trace it all the way back. And Christianity has not changed since the first century. There's a bunch of people that'll tell you that it was kind of all revised and altered in 300 AD by Constantine. That is not true. That is demonstrably not true. All you have to do is read the early church fathers and their letters back and forth, and they read exactly like the New Testament. Okay? So, we are grafted into Abraham. Can you name 5 Protestant Christian countries? Can you think of 5 Protestant Christian countries that are characterized by poverty, illiteracy, and human rights abuses? Can you name 5? Now, can you name 5 countries that are atheist or Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim that are not characterized by poverty, illiteracy, and human rights abuses? The 20% of the world that has 80% of the wealth and 80% of the education and 80% of the prosperity is the 20% that's 80% Christian. It's not an accident. A lot of people don't appreciate that when Jesus is the ultimate simplifier. He reduced 613 commandments to 2. Okay? Which, by the way,
That is a wealth formula. My 3-year-old is all over her iPad every day. Right? The iPad is simple enough for a 3-year-old or even a 2-year-old to, you know, sit there, right? Y'all got kids, grandkids? Ever tried to install a Windows printer driver? You notice that iPads don't have printers? That's on purpose. If you could print from an iPad, it would become a big, complicated boondoggle. So Steve Jobs made a really, really, really simple computer that anybody can use, and it's a sensation. Simplification is a gift of God. What's the book of Proverbs? What is a proverb? A soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. It is a simplification. Wisest man on earth, Solomon, wrote a book of simplifications. If you ask God, how do I simplify this? I'm in this marketplace. I'm in this segment. I'm in this product category. I have this service. How do I reduce 613 instructions down to 2? And he'll show you. Now guess what? He'll probably show a few other people too. And now it's a race to see who does it. History is full of people that like sat around and failed to act on the idea. Now, one of the things that people chronically do, and this is especially true of any kind of inventor, you know, people that, you know, any flavor of inventor at all, they're like, oh, I got this idea, it's so cool. Okay, so I'm going to sit in my little closet for probably, well, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. Well, they don't really think about how long it's going to be. It's just not today. It's like next month, next year, you know, and they polish it, and they apply for patents, and they do trademarks, and they keep it a secret, and they're not going to tell everybody about it. Dude, sell it. Go out and find out if anybody's going to buy it. Just because it's a good idea, seems like a good idea to you, it does not mean anybody's going to like it, does not mean anybody's going to buy it, and probably when they do, it's going to be in a different shape and form than it is now. Because you have to submit it to the laboratory of reality where real people can use it. It's hard to get people to accept new ideas. Don't worry about them copying them. If they're going to copy them, first of all, they can't be a poodle. They have to be a wolverine. Or they're not going to do anything at all. Okay, and then they have to stop what they're doing, go start doing this thing, and then, right? So, like, I'm not saying to be cavalier about it, but you got to get it out there. Make a dollar. Get somebody to pay you money. And another thing, I remember, this is just a perfect example, but people do it all the time. I remember one time a guy came over to my house and he did some carpentry work. And I said, how much do you owe me? Do I owe you? And he goes, I charge $35 an hour. You know, and it was like very deferential. I'm like, man, well, first of all, I don't really think that's a lot of money for carpentry work. Does anybody think that's a lot of money for carpentry? I don't think it is. So he's like the cheapest guy in town. And he did good work. And he's ashamed to ask for the check. I think being afraid to ask for the check is absolutely one of the biggest, you know, diseases that entrepreneurs have. Okay? And, you know, they're you know, even if, especially their friends, right? It's like, oh, well, you're my friend, so I'm just going to give you this discount. And it's like, you know, it's okay to give your friends a discount, but if you're going to do it out of strength, not out of weakness. Don't do it because you're ashamed to ask for the money. And I seriously had to totally get over this, okay? So a lot of you know, like, I charge a lot of money and my fees are really high and stuff. Okay, you got to understand something. I remember, okay, so my dad, he worked at this nonprofit organization, and, you know, my mom's got this story of how there was no food in the house, and she has her little baby who's my big sister, and there was nothing to eat, and she had 18 cents. And she went to the store praying that there would be something she could buy for 18 cents. And the cheapest thing in the store was a can of beans, and it was 19 cents. And she's standing there and going, God, what am I going to do? And then a guy comes and he marks it from 19 down to 18, and she bought it. Okay? Now this is my mom's God comes through for you story. The guy marks it from 19 cents down to 18, and then you eat beans. And that's like God coming through for you. Now, God bless mom, that's great, but like this is the story of the household. Like, right? This is where we're at, right? And my dad goes and he asks for a raise because he can't feed his family. And his boss says, well, Bob, first of all, if we gave you a raise, then we'd have to give this other guy a raise, and then he would make more money than Mr. Epp. And Mr. Epp took a vow of poverty. He's also, like, I think a single guy, or maybe he's married, but he doesn't have kids, so, you know. So, like, everybody is, like, below this poverty line. And, you know, and he goes, plus, if we gave you more money, then we'd have to take money away from the missionaries who are doing the Lord's work, you know. And so it's like, oh, you want more money? Guilt, 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 guilt. Right. And when he told me the story, I don't even know why he said this, but it was in the air, I guess. I go, you asked for a raise? Like, even the idea of asking, like, horrified me. You know? Look, every time I was at the grocery store and I want something, you know what the answer was? No. No, you can't have that. No. No. Right? Okay. So, if you're a subject matter expert, if you're a consultant, if you provide some kind of boutique service, if you want to be the highest quality brand in your marketplace, you need to be expensive, not cheap.
Exactly.
Okay? So you have to get over this. Solomon did not shop at Walmart. Okay? And I'm not putting down Walmart. Okay? But there's not like some virtue in like, okay, I'm just going to take this little crumb and, you know, look. We live in a very prosperous society. There's more than enough money sloshing around out there. If you go to the ocean with a bucket and you take a bucket, it doesn't matter if it's a 1 gallon bucket or a 5 gallon bucket or a 20 gallon bucket, the ocean doesn't really care. So, do you want a 1 gallon bucket or you want a 20 gallon bucket? And again, this is head trash stuff. And I would suggest, if you have financial head trash, I would suggest that you book a Sozo session with somebody at GCC, this church, it's on the website, and come and pay your $50, and like, what's your presenting issue? Well, you know, I got this anxiety about money. Every time I ask somebody for $35 an hour, I start stuttering and everything, you know, and they'll lead you to, God will show you what that came from, and you'll get it healed. And now, if you can afford more than $50, go to Margaret Nagib, who's like a Sozo ninja, and she'll charge you $175 an hour, and she'll work on you. And I send all kinds of clients to her, and they come back raving. And I don't get a cut. So, don't, you know, totally objective advice here. Let's see. There's probably just a couple more things, and then... Oh, well, you know, let's take a break. I've been going for a long time, and then we'll come back and we'll do Q&A. How's that? Is that good? Okay, 10 minutes, come back at 20 after, we will start at 20 after. You got 12 minutes to go do whatever you want to do and get a break.